It's a new era for U.S.-Europe relations.
Really what we could be looking at is, you know, not just another version of the Cold War, but one where the United States is seen to be either, not on the side of Europe or more on the side of Russia.
Challenges to Syria's unity.
My worry is that they end up to the conference that it does not magnify the real voices of these diverse Syrians.
And activists in Uganda demand the release of an opposition leader.
We call on the Ugandan authorities to immediately release Kizza Besigye.
Today is Wednesday, February 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Our top story today concerns Ukraine.
U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met in Saudi Arabia to discuss, among other things, ending the nearly three-year war that started after Russia invaded Ukraine. Interestingly, Ukraine was not invited to the meeting. VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell has our story.
The negotiating table to end the brutal war in Ukraine was set as officials from Washington and Moscow, but not Kyiv, sat down Tuesday in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, to hash out Ukraine's future. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio said the two sides agreed broadly on embassy staffing and on creating a high-level team for peace talks. At his estate in the U.S. state of Florida, President Donald Trump expressed optimism and batted away criticism that Ukraine should have been invited.
I think I have the power to end this war, and I think it's going very well. But today I heard, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
Trump also noted that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's approval ratings have fallen from their sky-high levels at the start of the conflict and hinted at a negotiating condition.
When they want a seat at the table, you could say the people have to, wouldn't the people of Ukraine have to say, like, you know, it's been a long time since we've had an election. That's not a Russia thing. That's something coming from me and coming from many other countries also.
In the Turkish capital of Ankara, Zelensky lobbied to be included in all talks, alongside partners like the European Union and Turkey.
I am convinced that for Ukraine and for our region, for Europe, it is critical that any negotiations to end the war are not happening behind the backs of the key parties affected by the Russian aggression.
Russia's foreign minister dismissed the idea of enlarging the table.
The European philosophy hasn't gone anywhere, so I don't know what they should do at the negotiating table. If they are going to whistle out some cunning ideas about freezing the conflict while actually intending, as is their custom, nature, and habit, to continue the war, then why should we invite them at all?
Analysts say they see some logic to that, with Kyiv and Moscow so far apart. Fred Kagan is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute.
I think it's a little bit, there's a little bit of overwroughtness about how the Ukrainians are being cut out from Riyadh and so forth. It's just the situation is not entirely clear, but a parallel track diplomacy is not optimal, but not necessarily terrible, considering how far apart the sides actually are.
Trump has spoken openly about some of his terms, which some analysts question. Charles Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
The one criticism that I would levy at the Trump administration is that I think it has given away too much, even before any serious discussions have taken place, saying no U.S. boots on the ground, no NATO membership. This is all putting the cart before the horse, because we need to get a deal to stop the killing.
Rubio said talks would continue, but didn't say whether the next round would include Ukraine. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
As we've heard, it's been a tumultuous few days in U.S.-Europe relations, from Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth saying in Brussels that the U.S. doesn't support NATO membership for Ukraine, to Vice President J.D. Vance in Munich showing support for far-right-wing political parties, and finally, President Donald Trump speaking with Russian President Vladimir Putin and setting up a meeting between Russian and American envoys to discuss Ukraine without Ukraine being present.
For a deeper dive into it all, I'm joined by Allison McManus. She's Managing Director for the National Security and International Policy Department at the Center for American Progress.
J.D. Vance's speech was received more as a direct attack on the alliance itself, shared principles of democracy, and the fact that he spent more time with the leader of the far right, AFD, than he did with many other European leaders, really drove that point home, that really what we're looking at now is not necessarily an alignment of states across the Atlantic in the interest of collective security, but an alignment of far-right political movements across the Atlantic in ways that may actually undermine that security.
Well, was he denigrating the alliance itself, or was he simply stating the new parameters for it?
I think that's open to interpretation. Certainly there's a need, and I think this is well recognized from many European allies, for Europe to take more seriously its own defense needs. And certainly that's not something that would harm or undermine the alliance. I think what is harmful is the context in which he's making these statements, which is not a context of we value these partnerships and these alliances because this is what's kept us collectively safe and stable and protected this democratic transatlantic security order. It's coming against the backdrop of course, direct overtures and meetings with Vladimir Putin to discuss the future of Ukraine and to discuss, frankly, the future of Europe without having Europeans or Ukrainians at the table. It's coming against the backdrop, again, of meetings with far-right political leaders in countries, as opposed to meeting with spending time with the heads of states of those countries. And so I think the way that this is read is not necessarily, hey, let's all do our part to steward this collective democratic and security alliance. It's you guys are kind of on your own now. We're going to cut you out as we cut deals with your major adversary, Vladimir Putin in Russia.
How do you suggest the Europeans and the Ukrainians and the sort of other folks in the world who have vested interests in this go forward? How can Europe now deal with the United States when this is the American posture?
Well, it's clear already the Europeans, they have been and they are continuing to grapple with what this new posture means. We know that as of the past month since the presidential election in the United States, European leaders have been gathering, have been trying to understand what it will mean to chart the course for Europe very much on its own without the support of the United States. Again, that means greater investments in their own defense industries. That may mean rethinking some of the ways that Europe has traditionally relied on the U.S. defense industry. That will take a much longer time than I think, these Ukrainian negotiations, the timeline of the Ukrainian negotiations. We saw right after Vance's speech in Munich that Emmanuel Macron brought together some of the largest nations in the EU as well as the UK to think about how Europe may, one, be able to provide some of its own security guarantees to Ukraine in the event that Trump decides not to and that they cannot rely on the United States. I think there's going to be some real consideration of what deterrence to Russia looks like. Again, if the message is that the United States is no longer to be relied upon and Putin believes that he may be able to go farther than invasion in Ukraine and start looking at other European territories, that may mean rethinking nuclear postures. Really what we could be looking at is, not just another version of the Cold War, but one where the United States is seen to be either, you know, not on the side of Europe or more on the side of Russia.
Allison McManus is Managing Director for the National Security and International Policy Department at the Center for American Progress. Ms. McManus, thanks for your time. Thanks for your analysis on this.
Thanks so much for having me.
Turning now to the Middle East, Syria's top diplomat says the country has gained freedom while managing to avoid another civil war. But observers point to major challenges ahead, such as the dire economy, uncertain security, and including Syria's diverse population in decision-making and governance. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports.
Syrian Foreign Minister Assad al-Shibani told the Munich Security Conference last weekend that the country's new leadership will set in place a government that reflects the will of the people.
Syrian people free themselves by themselves. We are now putting the steps and principles to have a system that represents the Syrian people to be a Syrian-led, Syrian-owned. The dictatorship will not repeat it again.
Al-Shibani said the country's Islamist interim leaders want to bring the whole Syrian society with us to prevent any actions that will break this stability and our achievement. Bassam Syed Ishaq is president of the Syriac National Council of Syria, based in northeast Syria and representing Syriac Christians. He told VOA it is important for Christians and all minorities in a post-Assad government to be represented and respected. Ishaq spoke about a national dialogue conference scheduled for next month.
My worry is that they end up with the conference that it does not magnify the real voices of these diverse Syrians. I am serious because this has been the traditional way. Assad did it this way. We just need a viable representation of everybody, whether it's a Kurd, Syriac, Druze, Alawi, Ismaili. We just need to hear these voices. We need to be able to hear people who are different, of different opinion, and think of real solutions.
Syrian-American lawyer Dima Musa, who is a member of the Syrian National Coalition, an organization that promotes constitutional reforms, says the caretaker government is applying the Islamist principles it enforced when it ruled just Idlib province to the rest of the country. She told the Washington-based Arab Center recently, the interim leaders have not yet completely come out of that mentality, but she expressed optimism for the future.
Inclusivity is probably one of the most important issues on the table today. And if it's not carefully and diligently worked on, especially at the national conference stage, it can set up for failure and recurrence of many problems in the future. There have been some positive steps that are getting lost amid the hardships of the living conditions and some incidents in some of the more sensitive areas that have historically had sectarian tensions, which were amplified during the last 14 years.
Some observers are concerned about a lack of clarity on how the new government will attempt to heal the still divided country. Questions remain over Syria's future relations with Russia and Iran and stalwart Assad supporters as it pursues reintegration in the Arab fold. Meanwhile, Syria's economy is in tatters after nearly 14 years of civil war, widespread corruption under the Assad regime, and sanctions by the West, including on its banking sector. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, told the Munich Security Conference the Syrian interim government faces enormous humanitarian challenges as 17 million refugees and internally displaced people try to return home. They need to see that there is a future in Syria, and they need to see it quickly, Pedersen warned. Dale Gavlak, VOA News.
After a plane crash in Toronto's Pearson Airport, Greater Toronto Airport's CEO Deborah Flint thanked the flight crew and first responders on Tuesday. She told reporters that the two remaining hospitalized passengers did not face life-threatening injuries.
It's really incredible. And when you see that aircraft, it just makes you really thankful for all the safety checks.
A team of investigators from Canada's Transportation Safety Board are leading the probe into what caused the plane to flip after landing. They're getting assistance from the U.S. National Transportation Safety Board and the Federal Aviation Administration. The weather at the time of the crash was reported as gusting crosswind and blowing snow.
And here are more stories we're following from around the world. The Pope's condition appears to be worsening. On Tuesday, the Vatican said Pope Francis had developed pneumonia in both of his lungs and that his respiratory infection also involves asthmatic bronchitis, which required the use of cortisone antibiotic treatment. The Pope is in good spirits and is grateful for the prayers for his recovery, Vatican spokesman Matteo Bruni said in a late update.
Mexican Economic Minister Marcelo Ebrard says he'll meet on Thursday with Trump administration officials in Washington for the first of a series of negotiations between the two countries. The meeting comes at a fragile time for the two neighbors, which generated more than $800 billion in bilateral trade last year. U.S. President Donald Trump has threatened to impose 25% tariffs on all imports from Mexico and signed an executive order to rename the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. Speaking to the press on Tuesday, Ebrard seemed determined to avoid escalation.
Israeli troops remained in some areas of southern Lebanon on Tuesday, despite a deadline for their withdrawal as part of a ceasefire with the militant group Hezbollah. Israel withdrew from some villages in the region, but said it was leaving forces in place in five positions that it said were necessary to protect parts of northern Israel. A joint statement from Lebanon's president, prime minister, and parliament speaker Tuesday called on the UN Security Council to demand Israel's immediate withdrawal. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Checking in on American politics, Donald Trump's administration scored a victory on Tuesday when a judge ruled against a group of state attorneys general opposed to the actions of Trump ally and chief government cost cutter Elon Musk. Freddie Joyner of Reuters has our story.
A Washington, D.C. judge on Tuesday refused to block Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, from firing federal employees or accessing sensitive government records. The ruling in favor of the Trump administration comes after Democratic attorneys general from 14 states filed a lawsuit arguing that Musk lacks legal authority to direct the mass firing of federal employees or access sensitive government computer systems. The billionaire Tesla CEO spearheads DOGE, which has swept through federal agencies, slashing thousands of jobs and dismantling various programs since Trump took office in January. The state attorneys general argued that Musk wields the kind of power that can be exercised only by an officer of the government, who has been nominated by the president and confirmed by the U.S. Senate, under language in the U.S. Constitution called the Appointments Clause. The states also have said DOGE itself has not been authorized by Congress. The judge wrote that the states, quote, legitimately call into question what appears to be the unchecked authority of an unelected individual and an entity that was not created by Congress and over which it has no oversight. But the judge said the states had not shown why they were entitled to an immediate restraining order. The judge could eventually rule in favor of the states, but said in the ruling that their request for an emergency court order was too broad and speculative.
That's Reuters' Freddie Joyner reporting for us.
South Africa will host its first major meeting as the current president of the G20 later this week, but the U.S. Secretary of State is skipping the forum's foreign ministers meeting, as Kate Bartlett reports from Johannesburg.
The chief diplomat of the world's biggest economy won't be attending a gathering of foreign ministers from the world's other large economies that starts Thursday.
I think the whole topic of the G20 gathering is one that I don't think we should be focused on, talking about global inclusion, equity, and these sorts of things.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio on February 6, explaining at a press conference why he is boycotting the foreign ministers' meeting in Johannesburg. He continued by saying the forum should be focused on issues like terrorism and energy security. Washington will likely have someone in attendance, Rubio said, but it is just not going to be him. Rubio had also posted on X, noting climate change was on the meeting's agenda and said his job was not to coddle anti-Americanism. There has been a swift deterioration in U.S.-South Africa relations under the new administration of President Donald Trump, who this month signed an executive order cutting off financial assistance to the country. The move came after he accused South Africa's government of land grabs and mistreating its white minority. The South African government says no land has been seized. Ronald Lamola, South Africa's Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, responded to Rubio's comments, noting the agenda had been adopted by all members of the G20 and carries on the themes from previous summits, like the one in Brazil last year. Here's the minister's spokesman, Crispin Fieri.
Our G20 presidency is not confined to just climate change, but also equitable treatment for nations of the global south, ensuring that we have an equal global system for all.
After Rubio pulled out of the G20 meeting, the EU expressed its support for South Africa, as did several European ambassadors to the country in a video message, including Italy's envoy, Alberto Vecci.
Like you, we are committed to multilateralism, rule-based international order, and more equity and justice in the world.
US rival China also expressed support for South Africa's G20 presidency, and its top envoy, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi, is expected to attend the event in Johannesburg this week. Russia likewise reaffirmed its commitment to the process, saying Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov would be present at the meeting. On Monday, Minister Lamola confirmed Washington would have someone at the foreign minister's meeting in Rubio's absence, though they said they did not have a name yet. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Africa, human rights activists, lawyers, and medical practitioners in East Africa are calling on the Ugandan government to release opposition leader Kizza Besigye, who was recently rushed to a hospital after going on a hunger strike to protest his imprisonment. Mohamed Yusuf has our story.
The Ugandan government is under fire for its trial of opposition leader Kizza Besigye and other political activists. Reading a statement on behalf of 12 organizations in Nairobi on Tuesday, the head of one of the groups, Khalid Hussein, said they condemned the militarization of justice and escalating government repression in Uganda.
We call on the Ugandan authorities to immediately release Kizza Besigye, Haj Obeid Lutale, Aaron Kizza, and others who are unlawfully detained. The abduction and rendition of Kizza Besigye and Haj Obeid Lutale blatantly violates international human rights law and the principles of extradition treaties.
A politician who ran against Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni in 3 elections, Besigye was abducted by unidentified men while on a visit to Kenya in November and taken to Luzira Maximum Security Prison in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. He appeared before a military court where former Kenyan Justice Minister and lawyer Martha Karua defended him. He is facing charges of treason, illegal possession of a firearm, and threatening national security. Last week, the 68-year-old fell ill and was rushed to the hospital after going on a hunger strike to protest his arrest and the charges. Ugandan lawyer Andrew Karamagi says the treatment of Besigye and other Museveni critics exposes ongoing rights violation in his country.
The medical union has spoken out and given a scientific medical analysis of Dr. Besigye's health, which is in serious jeopardy. Citizens who have attempted to protest this have as well been detained, and I should add, violently arrested, as some of you might have seen. This is a culmination of years of human rights abuses, disregard for the constitution.
On January 31st, the Ugandan Supreme Court ruled that the trial of civilians in a military court is unconstitutional and that such cases must be transferred to ordinary courts. But the government rejected this move, saying such trials protect the country from criminals. In a statement posted on X, Museveni called on those demanding the release of Besigye to instead demand a quick trial to establish the facts. Otherwise, he said, such demands promote insecurity, which is dangerous for the country. Amnesty International East African Regional Researcher Ronald Ebole says a united voice against human rights violations can help end the abuses against people.
We are having cross-border repression. We are having a transnational repression where we are seeing abductions happening beyond borders. And these abductions are happening sanctioned or blessed by presidents, blessed by heads of state. And they are taking advantage of the fact that at the ground, we are not as united against them.
Rights groups say they will circulate petitions and will reach out to other states and non-state actors to demand the release of Ugandans unlawfully detained. The 12 organizations that took part in today's demonstration have called for people to join a march on Friday to the Ugandan High Commission in Nairobi and the Parliament building to present a petition for justice and the release of Besigye and those detained alongside him. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.